Hello, I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager, and welcome to In Conversation With, the podcast series that delves into the world of financial services and brings you face-to-face with some of the most notable figures in the industry. Listen as we discuss topics that are currently facing the industry and hear from visionary CEOs to disruptive innovators as we bring you a diverse array of voices and perspectives. We'll explore the challenges they faced, the lessons they've learned, and the insights they have to share about the ever-evolving landscape of financial services.
Hi, I'm Lois Vallely, Chief Reporter for Money Marketing, and today I am here with Peter Dalgleish, who is Chief Investment Officer at Parmenion. Hi, Peter. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you today?
Very well, Lois. Thank you.
Good, good. So maybe to start off, you could introduce yourself and say a bit about how you got to where you are today.
Yes. I joined financial services 30 years ago, pretty much. I took a job for life, was into an institution called Barings. That came to a slight premature end with Nick Gleeson. But actually, like all these things, every cloud has a silver lining. And I moved on to Jupiter. And I was focused on the Asia Pacific and subsequently the emerging market space. I moved through a variety of different organizations. From Jupiter through to Gartmore, F&C. And then we as a family made it to a lifestyle change out of London. And I was looking for a role closer to home. We moved down to the southwest near Bristol. And a very old colleague pointed me towards an organization which was relatively new at that point in time, Parmenion, which was focused on the retail marketplace. And it's been a very steep learning curve ever since. And it continues to represent its challenges, but also its opportunities. And we continue to put forward our positions and have support advisors in a scalable and efficient manner for the benefit of their clients.
Excellent. So as Chief Investment Officer, what does your role sort of look like on a day-to-day basis at Parmenion?
It's a variety of roles from, to looking at the macro through to the underlying funds that we hold for each of the asset classes and thinking about where the risks lie, both on the upside as well as the downside, and to what extent those correlations between the asset classes are working or not. Therefore, to what extent, are we confident in delivering the consistency of risk-adjusted returns that we endeavor to deliver for advisors and their clients? It is overlaid with, I sit on the executive committee, so there is a number of sort of strategic responsibilities that I carry as well. But the primary focus is on the management of and the oversight of our investment solutions, as well as the communication. Communication is a core component. You really can't provide enough information to advisors and their clients in order to be able to assure them, because markets don't go up in a straight line, of where things are going right, but also where things are going not so right.
Yeah, definitely. I'm always interested by the graphs that are made of really long-term, investment trends and how it's always going up, but very raggedy line.
They conceal a number of small and nuanced cycles within that long-term trend.
Yeah, definitely. So I know Parmenion recently announced some changes to its tactical asset allocations. So could you just tell us a bit about why you made those changes and also a bit about what the outlook is for 2024?
Yes. We've been wary that after the fastest pace of interest rate rises since the 1980s, risks to global growth were skewed to the downside, was our concern. However, what we've seen is that actually economies have held up much better than expected, especially in the US, where the strength and resilience in the labor market has underpinned consumption, and then that's ultimately fed through into corporate earnings, which have delivered typically to a solid mid-single digit, albeit very much driven by the Magnificent Seven, which we're all too well aware of. But coupled with that, you know, so inflation has been continuing to trend lower, albeit more slowly of late. And we're increasingly minded that any sort of economic slowdown is likely to be sort of short and shallow. And therefore, we can start to look forward to the prospect of an improved growth outlook into the latter part of this year, but specifically into 2025 and probably into 2026, as some of the interest rates roll off from their peaks. This is all really quite encouraging from an investor's point of view at a high level. But the challenge, as always, is to try and figure out, you know, to what extent is that already discounted in the markets? And to this extent, whilst we're more positive looking forward, we are also cognizant that a lot of that optimism is it's beginning to be factored into certain areas within equities and fixed income. So I think your care and selectivity is definitely required, as well as looking to incorporate some hedges in case a softer than expected outcome does actually come about. So in terms of our activities, we've been looking to add some risk within our solutions, but we've got a much greater comfort of leaning into those areas that have lagged, but which also should benefit if a soft landing does actually happen. And in this case, it's we think to a mid and small caps are such an area of great interest. So this is what we've been adding to within the portfolios, funded by reduction in cash. We believe mid and small caps offer really good value for long-term investors, and that they're effectively priced for a recession. And what's more, you know, if interest rates do actually start to come down, they'll be one of the greatest beneficiaries, as their cost of debt is typically closely linked to floating rates.
Okay, interesting. And so this move towards this increased exposure to global small caps, do you think this is a sort of move away from liquid or cash funds? And in your opinion, should advisors be, as it were, like dipping their toes back into equities?
Yeah, I think on the surface, you know, there has been a flight to safety through 2023 on the back of what was a really difficult 2022. And some of those yields that became available for fixed deposits were really very interesting and very attractive for many investors. And so that doesn't surprise that trend occurred. And our own money market solution called PIM Sterling, you know, currently has a yield of 5.28%, which again, on the surface, that's really actually very attractive. But as I mentioned earlier, the expectation is that central banks are increasingly gaining scope and latitude to cut rates. And that was very much evident in recent central bank meetings over the last couple of weeks. And what that means is that for those investors currently in money market funds with fixed term deposits, there's a reinvestment risk. As those mature, you know, what will the rates be when they look to reinvest those monies? And that is what we mean by reinvestment risk. And it's going to be lower than, it's likely to be lower than what it's currently at. And at a point in time when nominal yields in fixed interest are attractive, it means that that opportunity cost for those investors actually is incrementally set to increase. furthermore, I think the reset in bond yields for investors offers them an opportunity to not only capture an attractive nominal yield, but also importantly, the scope for capital appreciation as rates come down. And if economies were to slow, we would expect the defensive characteristics of bonds to offer investors greater diversification as correlations with equities fall, or they may even move negative. So I think those are the sort of dynamics that we're thinking about. And you know, to what we can see that the material monies that have gone into money market funds, you know, to the number that is bandied around is $6 trillion in money market funds, of which, putting in that in percentage terms, through 2023, that grew, it's just in excess of 25%. You know, I am of the opinion that as rates slowly come down, that those monies will look to find their way into equities and fixed interest, but probably start off with fixed interest. But for the more braver individuals, they'll be interested in the equity side of things. So that is probably leans into your second question. You know, to what extent should we be comfortable about dipping our toes back into fixed interest and equities? I think there are a couple of other things to bear in mind. Is that from a cyclical perspective, you know, we are increasingly seeing signs that slowdown in global growth looks like it is going to be relatively modest and short in its duration. And so as we look forward into 2025 and into 2026, growth does look as if it's set to improve, which will help support corporate earnings and thereby company share prices, typically speaking. And, you know, for that reason, we think equities are looking increasingly more interesting. I think the second aspect is what we've already touched on, which is, you know, inflation, you know, is showing a downward drift, and that trend is likely to be to persist, albeit with some bumps along the way, which will allow central banks to reduce their restrictive policies, and that with lower interest rates, that will tend to be good fixed interest as well as equity valuations. So those are some of the factors that we're considering as to why at this particular point in time we are increasingly, albeit still wary, we're increasingly too optimistic that looking forward on that longer term perspective, things are set to improve.
Interesting. That sounds quite positive from a personal perspective, because I checked my pension the other day. I've got it in this sort of not high risk, but sort of it adjusts according to what's going on in the world. And the majority of it seems to be in equities at the moment. So hopefully it'll be positive for me. So 2024 has been dubbed the ultimate election year. I think there's like something like 64 countries are having elections, and the European Union, obviously. And obviously here in the UK, we've got one due some point in this year. So should advisors be concerned about these upcoming elections leading to market volatility, do you think?
So I think it's always prudent to be on the lookout for the unexpected, and elections definitely fall into this category. I think of over recent years, that's probably all the more relevant and pertinent than, you know, to looking back over longer time horizon. But what I think it's really important for investors to bear in mind is that when you look at history, generally markets, they tend to look through the political noise. And they why is because markets are really focused on the long-term prospects for growth, for inflation and interest rates. And as a result, my inclination is that, you know, elections are going to make for busy newspaper headlines, but unlikely to extend much beyond that from an investor's point of view. Nonetheless, there is a need to keep a watchful eye out for unexpected changes in policy, just in case. And I suppose that's a final aspect to, and we really can't afford to be complacent. Please don't or do hear that message. Is that of those elections that have already occurred so far, year to date, they've actually not, the outcome hasn't necessarily been what the markets were looking for, but have the markets experienced, you know, undue volatility? I think the conclusion of that is probably not. And so where would I refer us to? You know, if we look at Taiwan, well, you know, the pro-independence party DPP got into power. There was a wash of excitable press articles written about what China would do on the back of that. Well, actually, it's turned out that it's been a bit of the shrug of the shoulders, and it's been business as usual as thus far. To always be careful, I'm setting up myself for a fall. But it would appear that a lot of these things, so long as they are well known about in the marketplace and therefore reasonably well understood, and dare I say it, discounted, then the markets aren't really going to be unduly perturbed. Now, bear in mind that we did have a Truss Kwarteng experience not that long ago. You know, it's a prudent and appropriate for us to not lose sight of that. If you get significant policy change, then that is something that we do need to be really wary or on the lookout for.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And of course, investing is for the long term. So a bit of short-term volatility shouldn't do too much damage, hopefully.
Indeed.
So how do you consider political events impacting investment outlook and asset allocation decisions?
So as I said, Edouard, the focus is really much more around policy and our expectations for growth, for inflation and interest rates. And so therefore, in terms of the political cycle, we know that investors dislike uncertainty. And so to a greater or less extent, continuity is a good thing. But what I would be equally mindful of is that we also need to embrace change. And I can look at the UK as an example in that regard, whereby we have a productivity problem. And we've had that for many years now. And whilst it's talked about at length, there doesn't seem to be a political appetite to really to grasp the nettle. And that is to our detriment from an international competitiveness perspective. But from what I can see, some of the proposed policies that are being floated around by the a Labour government were it to get into power, really to starts to give you some confidence or interest that some of that supply side reform that they're talking about could be actually quite important for improving the growth outlook on the back of enhancing UK productivity. So that's one thing. I think call out the US. The US. It depends which to a media outlook you to look at in terms of to what's the poll ratings between Trump and Biden. The latest piece that I saw, once you strip out the independents, puts Biden much closer to Trump. So it will be a two-horse race. They are both known entities. So the surprise factor, I think, is unlikely to be there. Where is there scope for positive or negative surprise? From the perspective of I'm less worried about Trump getting in and causing market disturbance and worries than I think some of the media would have us believe. Because I think a lot of, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act introduced by the Biden, the greater proportion of the beneficiaries of that are actually Republican states.
Right.
So therefore, would Trump repeal that? I'm not quite so convinced. And notwithstanding that, he's were he to get into power, I would anticipate him to be very vocal and somewhat provocative, but that I think on some of the underlying policies are unlikely to materially change, and therefore the growth trajectory for the US has probably continued to be one of somewhat of a slowdown for 24 before incrementally improving into 25 and 26. Where I think that there is going to be change were Trump to get in is probably the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. We know that he hasn't necessarily seen eye to eye with Jay Powell in the past, and so therefore it's prudent to assume that there's likely to be some change there. And that will have a bearing on interest rates and monetary policy. So that is something that does need to be borne in mind.
Yeah, definitely. It's a race between two very old horses, isn't it? I feel like they need some new blood or something.
It is. I was. It was floated to me because out of the whole of the US, are those really the two best presidential candidates?
And how many people live in the US?
Well, indeed. At which point maybe it was, you know, the retort was along the lines of, well, maybe the rest are just too sensible and they don't want to be president.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't if that was even possible. Anyway, what's your view on the UK as an asset class? Should we be worried about home bias, in your opinion?
So I think the flow of money out of the UK has been relentless, and notably since 2016. And if we look at some of the stats on this, you know, so the UK weightings in UK pension funds has collapsed from around about to 40% in the 1980s to approximately 5 to 6% today. That really does explain some of that persistent outflow, but it's been coupled with, you know, UK open-ended funds. They've now seen, I think it's 33 months of consecutive outflows. That clearly hasn't been helped by retail investors who have redeemed, partly due to that, you know, to a historical high in terms of cost of living and that cost of living crisis. And they've looked to try and make ends meet. But what it has meant is that, you know, to valuations in the UK are now down to historical lows. And that in of itself is interesting, but a cheap valuation is never a sufficient catalyst. You need something else. And that catalyst is hard to identify. But I will point to a few reasons as to why things, I think, are set to sequentially improve. So firstly, inflation. We're expected to get close to target, the 2% target. You know, to some who are expecting even that to come about in this month, so the month of April. So that'll be announced in May. I'm probably a bit more guarded in that. So let's say early summer, at which point, you know, the Bank of England is likely to have the wherewithal to be able to reduce rates. And that will act as a support to not only liquidity, but also valuations. A second aspect is in terms of positive real incomes. We've come through a period with that very difficult cost of living, whereby household incomes have been really squeezed. Well, we're now on the prospect with declining inflation for those incomes in real terms to turn notably positive. Which when combined with a revival in the housing market, which we're already beginning to see signs of, is lifting consumer confidence, which is likely to lead to better than expected GDP growth. You know, I think that the OBR had been forecasting around about 0.7%. Well, were this all to manifest itself, I can see it. There's every reason why GDP growth will be comfortably in excess of 1% through 2024, with considerable scope for upside above that. And what that will therefore feed into is corporate earnings surprises. The third aspect is you know, improvement in global cyclical trajectory. And what that means for an index like the UK is, which has that cyclical bias to it in terms of energy, mining, industrials, consumer discretionary, that actually the UK market is probably reasonably well positioned to enjoy the fruits of that global cyclical improvement. So I suppose in aggregate, you know, it's for a market that is so unloved, underowned, oversold, and with such depressed expectations amongst investors, there's an increasing probability of positive surprise, which should ordinarily lead to a narrowing of that valuation differential versus some of the other developed markets, but specifically the US, given its stellar outperformance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from our point of view, you know, we have been underweight the UK, but it is a marketplace that we are increasingly looking to add to at the margin. And we've already started that through that increased allocation specifically to global small caps, which incorporates a healthy chunk of UK.
Mm. Okay. And I do have to ask what your view on the UK ISA is.
I think it's well-intentioned. I think its effectiveness is more in doubt. Why do I say that is because I think the statistics are along the lines of around about only 15% or mid-teens of investors actually use their maximum ISA allowance. So therefore, you know, the additional five on top is it's going to be great for those who can afford that. But in terms of its effectiveness on the market, I think it's, as I say, it's well-intentioned, but probably going to come short of on the delivery front. Where I would be more enthusiastic or encouraging, you know, the government or future governments to think about is, you know, to what extent can pension funds be required to have a higher weighting to the UK? And that's a very controversial statement. And I know there'll be plenty of pushback that, which I would adhere to, and which is that, you know, to having the flexibility to implement diversification is essential for, you know, the delivery of good client outcomes. And I fully subscribe to that. But I think when I see UK pension funds at 5 to 6% in terms of the weighting, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, some of the Global World Index has the UK, I think it's around about to a 3.5 to 4%. You know, that 5 to 6% indicates an overweight position. But nonetheless, unless we start to invest in our own companies, which don't forget, you know, specifically in the FTSE 100, you know, over 70% of their earnings are international.
Mm.
And therefore, are you buying purely UK companies? The answer, simple answer to that is no. Then actually you're encouraging investment into UK listed companies, which will help their cost of capital, which will improve competitiveness, which will help GDP growth, help employment growth, etc. And that's why I think I'm more minded that that would be an effective and constructive path to take.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's a good point as well about a lot of it being like not purely UK. Lot of companies, because that was one of the points that I heard when the UK ISA came out, like how is it even going to be vetted? But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why that consultation period is or process is being gone into.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be a hard one to overcome. But we'll see.
We will. And we'll have to end it there, I'm afraid. But it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much, Peter. I really enjoyed it.
Not at all. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation With. We do hope that you enjoyed it. Please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your podcasts from. You can also keep up to date with all our new content published on the Money Marketing website, as well as our print edition Money Marketing magazine. So make sure to subscribe. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. See you next time.